Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of The Damage Report under lockdown. It is a day, and a very special day indeed, because it's not only JR Day, but it is, as it should be, JR Wednesday. How's it going, JR?
I'm wondering at this point whether or not people just expect Tuesday now, because it's been such a regular occurrence.
Well, I don't know if everybody, like, it's not necessarily, there is a pattern to the guests, it's not necessarily obvious, but the fact that Emma does every other Tuesday leads to you guys switching every other week. People probably have started to catch on to that.
Yeah, if they realize what day it is anymore, yes, they have.
Mm-hmm. You know, I had briefly, while we were getting ready for this, and thank you for everybody who's already coming to the chat room, while we were waiting to go, I realized while we're like waiting to start, we always have a hot mic because, as many people have seen behind the scenes, it would take at least a little bit of work for me to not have the mics active. But then I realized it's actually not that difficult. And so I briefly turned it off. I saw one person get mad and I was like, okay, fine, I'll turn it back on. And so you got to hear our beard prep and drinking.
They could tell that you turned it off. I couldn't tell what there was, like a silence. It was usually
you'd still hear it, but it wouldn't go to the stream.
Right.
But it is there, everybody. It's okay. And also, whenever we start the stream, I always see at least one person say, I finally get to catch the show live. And I think, it's a quarantine. Where have you been these other mornings? I don't know. Maybe people are going on hikes or something.
Helping their kids on Zoom meetings for school.
That's probably true. Yeah, I guess actually teaching their kids. Whew. Okay, I take it back. That sounds rough. Thank you for being here, JR. Very much looking forward to doing the show with you. Thank you, everybody who's already in the chat room. Please hit the like button if you haven't already. There's certainly been a lot of people in the chat room asking you to, and we would appreciate that you do that. Also, you can interact with us live by tweeting at hashtag TDRLive. Participating in the super chat or just commenting, and we'll be reading some of those as we go along. We got a lot that we're going to be talking about today on the show. We've got an update on the incredibly irresponsible and dangerous rhetoric coming out of Fox News. We're going to get to that. Meatpacking plants, the target of the most recent invocation of the Defense Production Act. We've got, what's going to happen to workers who don't offer themselves up to be sacrificed on the altar of capitalism. Mike Pence unmasked. That should be exciting. And what does the NRA think you should do with your stimulus checks? I will give you one guess. Let's see if you can figure it out, people.
Rent?
Yeah, it's probably that. It's probably rent. Yeah, they're being oddly responsible. Anyway, so we're going to get to that over the course of an hour. Why don't we get started, JR? Lots of news to get to. Yeah. Oh, by the way, if you stick around to the end, if there's time, there is a new presidential candidate, or at least an exploratory committee. We're going to discuss that. Very exciting. Could reshape the entire race. So we'll give our thoughts on that near the end. Okay. You might have seen in the last week, a study has come out showing that they compared people who watched Tucker Carlson and people who watched Sean Hannity, and they found that watching Sean Hannity, because of his refusal to accept the seriousness of the pandemic, led to more cases of coronavirus. Now, obviously, both of them have been very defensive about President Trump and have not necessarily been saying what scientists say they should, but they gave credit in this study to Tucker Carlson for being more responsible. And he is not going to take that credit sitting down, because over the past couple of days, he has gone on a tear arguing that the lockdowns should end, that they were never necessary to begin with, and more. So we're not going to play everything because you'd literally lose your mind. But here's a little bit of a mashup of some of what Tucker Carlson has been saying recently on his show.
By the numbers, the annual flu is much more dangerous to children than the coronavirus is. Now, why is this relevant right now? Well, it's relevant because we've shut down education nationwide. Many schools and colleges are now considering staying closed in the fall. For the kids who go to those schools and their families, this is a disaster. Shut up and lock down, they say. You're saving lives when you do. People will die if you don't. Every day you hear that, but it's not science. Those are political slogans. You may remember what they first told us back in February and March. They said, we have to take radical steps in order to, quote, flatten the curve. Well, 6 weeks later, we're happy to say that curve has been flattened, but it's likely not because of the lockdowns. The virus just isn't nearly as deadly as we thought it was. All of us, including on this show, everybody thought it was. But it turned out not to be. Hospitals never collapsed. outside of a tiny number of places, they never came close to collapsing, at least not from an influx of infected patients. Instead, something remarkable happened, something amazing, really without parallel in American history. Matter. For example, we spent millions of dollars and more than a decade trying to find a vaccine for the SARS virus. Scientists never developed one. That's a shame. But did we halt life in the United States in response? We didn't. In fact, you may not even remember that any of that happened. The striking thing is the science has not changed that much since then. Unfortunately, American politics have changed a lot.
Okay, so look, that was a lot, and there's a lot to cover there. I mean, we could have taken any couple of minutes from his show. The sheer amount of condescending, disdain-fueled lack of understanding or appreciation for science there from this, and let's recognize this, as everyone always should, this incredibly wealthy and privileged elite, this heir to a fortune, Tucker Carlson, who loves to be talked about as if he's some sort of regular man who understands the struggle of regular people. I've got several points that I want to make, but JR, I'm going to give you first crack at it. What did you think about Tucker Carlson's new turn on coronavirus?
Okay, when you listen to guys like Tucker Carlson, his skill is based, and it can easily be overlooked. His skill is in saying things that are strictly his opinion and posing them as fact. So you have to look for evidence when people like him are talking. So I have to analyze these guys all the time. The easy ones are the Sean Hannitys of the world, who just, you know, they're puppeting talking points from Trump and they're looking to please him. Those are obvious. And people still like him because it feels good to have someone with that kind of platform saying the ridiculous things that are in your head in support of your president. So, but what Tucker Carlson does is he'll say, and we've reached that point and it's totally gotten there and we're done with it. Based on what? He just, those are opinions, but he's saying them like it's been established fact. So when you're listening to him, he'll pepper in some opinions, he'll fill it with opinions and pepper it with a couple of facts here and there to act like everything he's saying is a fact. I have a friend from college that was so good at that. He'd say things definitively. He'd say things without any kind of real evidence behind it. But he'd say it so convincingly to people that he'd go, oh, yeah, that's right. Chris said so. Let's go do it.
Yeah.
Yes, his name is Chris, but I'm not giving you his last name. But and I was always the guy who was like, Chris is BSing you guys. You didn't hear how empty that statement was, and no one knew it. So that's his skill in doing that. It has nothing to do with him actually giving you any kind of a fact that's basis for his argument. It's just his argument posed as facts.
Yeah. Yeah. He has mastered a sort of delivery that is supposed to stop you from recognizing that he is doing the same sort of explicitly biased partisan news coverage that all of the rest of the opinion people on Fox are, and indeed spreading conspiracy theories as well. But he talks in this tone, and even when he gets mad, he doesn't get as obviously mad as like a Sean Hannity or something like that. And he's reading it all off of a teleprompter, and so it seems reasonable. And he and a lot of on the right, there's these two doctors who run an urgent care or something like that in California, and they've said recently that based on their research, this is far less deadly than it was believed to be. So those two doctors, because they don't think that the quarantine is necessary, they've been all over Fox recently, and indeed Tucker Carlson in that show was using their work that's been described as incredibly reckless, riddled with basic statistical errors, all of it, and obviously the self-interest as well. But he uses it because he doesn't care. He's not interested in the peer review process of these urgent care doctors' work. It's convenient, and so he throws it out there. But just really fast to respond to a few of the individual things that he said. He's back to the regular flu is worse. He said, it's not bad for kids, so just send the kids back. Now, I really want to focus on this statement because we criticized Donald Trump for saying this incredibly ignorant thing yesterday, not understanding that even if we believe that kids are less likely to die from the coronavirus, they can carry it and spread it to other people. Seriously, they can give it to their family. They can give it to the elderly. They can give it to the immunocompromised. Kids are great at spreading disease. That's like the main thing they do for the first 7 years of their life. But Tucker Carlson is either so stupid that he doesn't understand that or doesn't care and doesn't want you to understand that. So when if you ever get some sort of knee-jerk need to give him some sort of credit for being intellectually honest or fair or free-thinking or anything like that, remember, he's willing to let your grandparents die by lying about the threat posed by kids going back to school. Beyond that, let's see. Remember, he's doing this show where he's saying the lockdowns aren't necessary. There's no proof they mattered. Right on the a couple days after research showing that the death toll in the first few weeks could be as high as twice as what was reported. He doesn't care about that. He's not interested in the actual numbers, unless it was done by those two doctors at an urgent care in California. He's willing to spread that. And overall, the point that I want to make about his commentary there is, what did we say at the very beginning when these measures were enacted? We said, if we are lucky, they will be so successful that they will be called unnecessary. Because he says, well, hospitals didn't collapse. Okay, but the whole point was to try to stop hospitals from collapsing by trying to limit how many people get coronavirus in a very limited amount of time. So that happened, and that is proof that it wasn't necessary. Somehow he thinks that even though we're still losing 1,500 to 2,600 people every single day, that's not impressive. He's not impressed by that. He thinks that everyone being out there congregating would have no greater amount of deaths. That this, I would honestly say, I am shocked at the extent to which Americans have complied with these lockdowns around the country. I would not have predicted that they would have, or that they would have ever been put into effect in the first place. But they were. He thinks none of that mattered, or at least there's no reason to believe that it would have mattered. That an infectious disease would not spread more if more people were around each other. And really fast, so he started off with the children's stuff, complete boneheaded, ignorant stupidity to say that it doesn't matter if the kids go back to school. But then he ended with the SARS thing, because again, like you said, like Chris, he wants to pretend that he's being reasonable. He's making a comparison to another pandemic. He says, well, we don't need a vaccine for SARS anymore. Yes, because SARS never got nearly as bad, partially because it's not nearly as infectious. It's harder to spread. This is a different disease. He's saying that not on like February 1st, he's saying it when 58,000 people have already died of the disease and thousands more die every day. He said there, the curve has already been flattened. Okay, like, look at this graphic. Yeah, I mean, I guess it's not still rising every day, but it's still thousands of deaths every single day, and he's not impressed. So the guy that gets given all this credit, even in that study that I was telling you about, he is saying that's not enough. These lockdowns shouldn't continue. They should have been put into effect in the first place. And understand he's saying that while he's, you know, broadcasting by himself, he's not having in-studio guests. Yep. He's protecting himself, as indeed all Fox hosts are. But the rest of you, you don't need these protections anymore. In fact, needed them.
They gave up the game from the beginning when the Glenn Becks of the world and Lieutenant Governor from Virginia, I believe it's Virginia, when they all said, hey, it's okay if we die for the sake of saving our economy for other people. Which, by the way, when they said we're willing to die, it doesn't mean themselves personally, even though Lieutenant Governor said so. I'm trying to blank on his name, Dan Patrick. There he is. So when those guys come forward and say things like that, they gave up the game a long time ago. So after that, everything that they've said as far as their argument against it, arguing against quarantine, arguing against the results, arguing against the fact that hospitals didn't get overrun and shut down, which, by the way, many hospitals are overrun. Yeah, let's keep it real. So just because they didn't literally collapse on themselves like an implosion of a building doesn't mean that they're not still pressed and stressed for equipment and are not overrun by patients when other patients that need other medical attention on a normal basis when a pandemic isn't stretching across the world are trying to get in there. These are the strains that happen. So let's not just write off the fact that hospitals are just doing great, because I know several nurses and none of them are doing great. Just to keep it real, none of them are doing great. So when they give up the game early on like that, and they know, and then from that point on, everything else they said you can now write off as BS or trying to fulfill that agenda of their predictions that none of this was a thing in the first place. So as you pointed out, put your money where your mouth is. Jump on that bus, Tucker. Take a trip down to Fox News headquarters and bang on the door for them to let you in. You're not doing that.
Yeah.
So apparently what you're looking for is for the minions who follow you to be your guinea pigs to allow this to continue so you can continue on with your economy. When he says we need to go ahead and risk ourselves to push this economy forward, he means you.
Exactly. And I'm not going to play the video I was going to, but Chris Hayes called him out and said, you know, go chop some pork if you want. I mean, after all, like, look at the industries that have continued. Like, the frontline workers are dying at high rates. People in meatpacking plants are getting exposed and dying. Grocery store workers are getting exposed and dying. People in transportation are getting exposed and dying. The things that haven't been shut down are severely limited because they are essential. They can't be shut down. Those people are disproportionately being affected. I think it sort of makes sense to imagine that if all the rest were still going on, we'd probably see a similar pattern. But you know what? I'm not Tucker Carlson. I just don't have that sort of amazing galaxy brain that he has. And really fast, well, I'm focusing on him here mainly because people don't seem to get that he is just as dangerous in his rhetoric as Sean Hannity, and perhaps more so because it's not as obvious. You know, he said in another show, the death rate is not devastating. Well, not to him, because he doesn't care. These are peasants dying. He's not interested in peasants. Another Fox host compared the need, saying that there's need for more coronavirus testing to the same thing as wearing a helmet if there's snow on the ground. It's not necessary. Why are you saying we need more testing?
Let's go with the whole helmet thing. So football players wear helmets and they get all these concussions and later in life, issues with their brain damage and all this stuff, which leads them many times to suicide or just pain for the rest of their lives. They wore helmets during their time playing football. It was a preventative measure, and it probably helped them not lose their lives while they were playing, mm-hmm. which would have happened. So if football players are wearing helmets, which they're trying to advance and make better, crazy how that works, you guys, so they can protect them further, do you now say, hey, what are we wearing helmets for in football? Because, you know, it protected people. Look, everyone's not dying on the field every day. Because, by the way, early football, American football, people died on the field from playing the sport. So now we're not doing that. So because we've made that change for this preventative measure of wearing helmets and shoulder pads and wrist pads and ribs and all this stuff to protect you from injury, should we not use it anymore because it worked? That's the logic we're going with.
It's not necessary.
Here.
Because you know what? Because it's more exciting for me to watch other people play without pads. So whatever. What if they get injured? Who cares? Another host said that COVID-19 is only terrible for a very small group of people. This is the pro-life group. That only kills some people, not others. And only people with, like, pre-existing conditions. You know, super rare things like heart problems, respiratory illnesses, diabetes. Those things that, you know, tens of millions of Americans don't have that stuff. And also on Fox News recently, Mike Huckabee and his guests suggested that the coronavirus is a Chinese bioweapon. So it's just, you know, workers need to be ground up. And, you know, conspiracy theories from, you know, from right wing websites. That's what it is. It looks nice, high production quality, but it's as crazy as anything on the internet.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it, "You must unlearn what you have learned." And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Donald Trump made a surprise announcement late last night saying that meat processing plants are going to continue operating, declaring them critical infrastructure as the nation confronts growing disruptions to the food supply. So they are going to be using the government and the DPA to do whatever they can to force these meatpacking plants to remain open. potentially doing this because a number have shut down because they have been sort of epicenters for the spread of coronavirus. We've already had, let's see, as of when I made these graphics, 20 meatpacking and processing workers have died from coronavirus. At least 6,500 have been affected. Huge numbers for one industry. According to the United Food and Commercial Workers International Union, at least 22 plants processing meat from pork to chicken have closed at some point after clusters of employees tested positive for COVID-19. So he is going to be forcing them to stay open. They're shutting down because of the fear that their workers are being exposed. And I would assume, I'm not an inspector of pork, I would assume the fear is that some of the meat might be tainted as well. And so they're shutting down. Something that, by the way, have you been given the impression over the last few years that meat processing plant CEOs are quick to shut things down when there's fears about health concerns? That they just do it willy-nilly at the first sign of any danger? That has not been my impression, JR.
When they catch, when they see anything in their processing or any of these, I guess, I'm not sure what there's a term to call for these specific plants where they toss the baby chicks into the grinder and all that stuff, those horrible videos that we've all seen. But when those happen and when there's a speck of any kind of germ or even dust, and they're on it, they clean it, they're not going to tolerate any kind of filth or disgusting conditions in their plants. We've seen that over and over and over and over again. So when something like this breaks out, whenever they let it happen, they know that it's a big problem. Mm-hmm. Sarcasm, by the way.
Yeah. Well, you need to make clear, JR, what you're supposed to do is you're supposed to say it, see how people respond, and then a day later say it was sarcasm. But anyway, so he's been very hesitant, by the way, Donald Trump, to use the Defense Production Act. He doesn't want to get involved or whatever. He didn't want to do it for masks and PPE, stuff like that, early on. For pork, he does. And okay, look, devil's advocate, a lot of people eat meat, they need access to food, whatever. I get that. What I would say is, if you are going to invoke this power of the government, which is very rarely used, to keep an industry open, that should be accompanied by the necessary guidance, oversight, and support to make sure that it's done in a safe way. And so let's turn now to all of the things the government is going to be doing to keep these workers and consumers of the food safe. The order did not detail additional precautions companies should take to protect workers, which has led to worries among unions and other workers' groups. Oh, no, they're not doing anything. They're saying you have to stay open. Have at it. Do whatever you want. We don't care. But in combination with that, so you have to stay open, even though it is not a hypothetical that this could lead to your workers dying and getting sick. Dozens have died. Thousands have gotten sick. We want you to stay open. We don't expect you to take any additional precautions. And in comments to the media earlier on Tuesday, Trump said he would also shield meatpacking companies from legal liability from worker claims of not being adequately protected, though the order didn't spell out any specifics. So you got to stay open. We're not going to require your companies to do anything different to protect your lives. And when you get sick and when you die, we are going to protect the company from any legal liability.
And also when it comes to unemployment collections or requests due to all this going on, if the company decides to reopen and force you to come back into very unsafe, potentially lethal conditions, if you decide not to, that's a voluntary quit, and you're also no longer eligible for unemployment.
Oh, we're going to get into those quotes in just a little bit. But isn't it interesting that this is the industry that he's choosing to make this move on? Like, I don't find it particularly surprising. I mean, we've been doing a lot of, like, we talk more about food production and regulations over than almost any other news show. But they've been, like, we understand that they're incredibly deferential to the desires of the fossil fuel industry, pharma, and stuff like that. But really, like, food manufacturers, when they want something, they get it. And this is just another example of it. And the thing is, like, the protection from legal liability involving coronavirus, like, I have no doubt that that is going to expand at some point. They want to be protected from lawsuits in all cases. And if you set this precedent where something that we know is going to affect a lot of people, that they won't have face any liability on it, why not blanket provide them with protection from other sorts of claims? The unions are seemingly terrified for good reason.
I don't know why they're getting involved. I thought Republicans, conservatives in general were against government getting involved with the day-to-day operations of a company. So, you know, we slash regulations, eliminate them in many other cases because we'll just trust the companies to do the right thing. Hey, why are we being so burdensome on these employees? Why can't we just trust them to do the right thing? Hey, if they have a beef with their company, sorry for the pun, if they have any kind of a conflict over this situation, why are we trying to put in any kind of rules that will protect companies from these people? Hey, just let the free market be the free market. If the employees decide not to work, hey, that's something the company has to figure out. If the employees decide to go in, hey, that's something the company's got to figure out. How come we're putting in things from the government to work in this exchange when we're supposed to just leave them alone? Leave them alone. Why are we doing this?
Well, you know, and that's almost exactly, I forget exactly who it was on Fox, but was saying this like a week or two ago, which is you don't need to do these lockdowns and stop people from going to these various companies because the companies, thanks to, you know, supply and demand and the wonderful power and motivating force of capitalism, they're going to voluntarily do everything that's necessary to not spread the disease because they don't want their brand associated with it. Like you're saying, if that's the case, government doesn't need to shield them. They're not going to need a shield because they're going to voluntarily create their own shield to protect their workers and their consumers as
well.
All
these corporations are amazing, beautiful people that want nothing but the best for the people that work for them.
So with the announcement that meat processing plants are going to be forced to remain open and that the companies are going to be protected from any liability, I'm curious, what's going to happen with the workers? Because I'm reading reports, quotes from people who work at these plants saying they don't understand how this is supposed to work. One named Donald is an employee at a Tyson's Waterloo, Iowa facility who said, "All I know is this is crazy to me because I can't see all these people going back to work. I don't think people are going to go back in there. I'm still trying to figure it out." What is he going to do, talking about Trump? Force them to stay open? Force people to go to work? Donald, that is a very good question. Yes, they are going to force you to go to work or else. And so what does that or else look like? Well, we have a quote from the governor of Iowa, Republican Kim Reynolds, who said, "If you're an employer and you offer to bring your employee back to work and they decide not to, that's a voluntary quit. Therefore, they would not be eligible for the unemployment money." So they're going to force you to go back to work. If you don't go back to work, you're going to lose access to all of those benefits. And by the way, she also said employers who have workers that refuse to return should file a report with Iowa Workforce Development. So between an employer whose employees don't come back, she's like, "I got advice for you. Go to this group. They're going to hunt those people down. If you're a worker who's afraid of getting and dying from coronavirus, I got no interest in you." Yep. You're quitting. No unemployment benefits. We're done with you.
You're un-American. You're expendable, and we were hoping you could be expendable at for our benefit. And since you refuse to, you're just expendable at your own expense. And we're going to make sure that you're out of our way. It's the weeding out of people that, like, the degree to which this whole pandemic has exposed our system and our economic system and our hatred towards our citizens is profound. And I need enough people to realize that because we're still sitting in the whole, like, "Oh, well, yeah, you know, I mean, they want the best for us." That's why when these checks go out, these $1,200 checks go out and Donald Trump's name is at the bottom of them, or he sends out the letter because he needs more people to see his name at the bottom of it. It's a continuing push to make sure that people think it's all them and you're still nothing. People have to start realizing that you have more power than them if you exercise it. But, you know, this is how they keep inflicting this on you to make you think, hey, we're going to put you in this corner. We're going to make sure that we supplement these companies, these corporations, to screw you over as much as possible, to beat you into submission. It's a partnership to destroy you if you don't do as you're told. It's crazy. And I know I sound crazy saying it, but that's the bottom line of this. All these different parameters and factors are put into place to where you have no choice anymore.
Yeah.
But they won't say it openly. They'll say that that's what others want that are actually looking to protect you.
They're not at the point of, like, sending the cops to drag you to your station, but they're doing everything they can to produce the same incentives. It's just amazing. I mean, how many times over the course of, like, the past month, since the reopen calls have gone about, have we made some sort of analogy to their willingness to, like, grease the gears of capitalism with the blood of workers, to grind them up and all that stuff? This is how they do it. And they're even doing it in an industry that is about grinding things up. It's really on the nose at this point. The analogy is super clean. Like, you think about it. your company's going to be forced to open. The CEOs don't get to choose. I don't think that they would. But they're not even getting to choose. So screw, you know, free market or whatever. They have to come open, which means that you have to go to work. You're going to be afraid of getting coronavirus. And if you don't go, that's a voluntary quit. You get no benefits, no unemployment, no anything like that. It's really amazing. Now, there's one other detail to this. Coming from Kim Reynolds. So the only exception for workers getting unemployment after not returning to work is if they are ill with the virus or taking care of a family member who has the deadly disease. So you won't be forced to go back to work if you already have the disease, which makes sense. Except that you will be forced to go and potentially get the virus.
Yeah.
So you don't have to go if you have a family member that already has the virus. You do have to go get the virus and give it to your family members. I really don't understand what passes for logic with Kim Reynolds here. The entire thing, it's like some sort of eldritch horror has come up with this plan. It is definitely going to result in more infections and more deaths in this industry. If I was one of the workers at one of these plants that's about to reopen, I would be terrified.
The policy is obviously there, not for the people who are advocating it. So, I mean, if Kim Reynolds has any family members that are going to bring the virus to her, she's shutting that down. Just saying.
Exactly. And by the way, it's not just Iowa that's going to have this particular policy. You've also got, according to the Texas Workforce Commission, to qualify for unemployment benefits in the state, a worker must be, quote, willing and able to work all the days and hours required for the type of work you're seeking. And so if employees who choose not to return to work, they will become ineligible for unemployment benefits. And if I was doing it, if Texas is doing it, you better believe that other Republican states are going to do it, especially after the precedent has been set. So we, like the working class, got a very small one-time stimulus. Trump sort of laughed off the idea yesterday of a second, even $1,200 check. Very limited protections in some areas from being fired without any sort of compensation, against being evicted and things like that. And those are already going away. And you are going to be forced to go back out there into a situation with the virus that is almost exactly the same as what you would have faced 6 weeks ago if we had never stopped before. They don't have any better treatment. They don't have a vaccine. We're barely doing more testing. We're not even doing half as much as experts say would be necessary to sort of justifiably restart the economy. And they have resisted all calls to get to that point. They could have easily done it. They could have started spending 6 weeks ago any number of billions of other people's dollars to create at least the cover in terms of testing necessary to restart things. But they want to have their cake and mash it in your face too. They want to restart, and they don't want to do what is necessary to protect you. I really don't understand it. It seems homicidal at this point, because again, it isn't their money they'd be spending. They could use taxpayer dollars, public money, to provide the personal protective equipment and testing to preemptively reopen the economy. They could do that. Mm-hmm. If that's what they want, is to get people back to work, get the economy roaring again, they could have done it, but they chose to just start it without the necessary protective measures. I really don't understand, other than, and this seems crazy, a desire to see workers die. I don't know what the other explanation is.
Well, it's the seeing workers die is just, it's a result of the policy, because, you know, it's capitalism. So the policy is get back to work, get these people back to what you need them to do by any means necessary. Get as much money as you can, spending as little as possible. That's the idea, right?
Yeah.
You're supposed to, if you have a company, you're trying to have very little amount you put out and try and get more in. So this is the same idea. It's just your workers are part of what you got to make sure that you utilize to get your money. So if the idea is to get things started without having to invest anything to make sure you protect the people who are getting you your stuff, hey, let's do it.
Yeah.
If they die, that's not me. This is capitalism, bro. You are expendable because I need to get my money. Bottom line.
Yeah. Yeah. And I really think that, I mean, they've been successful in tracking the spread of coronavirus in some areas to these meatpacking plants. This is one area where 90% of the cases were tracked back to one particular plant, and it's just going to become more common. And that meat goes all over. A few plants getting infected, the meat goes all over the country.
That's what I wanted to say. That was last thing. I'm sorry. I know I've been on this forever. This one thing about this is Tyson, I think food companies yesterday said that the food supply chain is getting severed, and you know, all these scary terms. Oh my God, we got to make sure we get back to work and send these guys to work. And the infection rate goes at this rate. what do you think is going to happen to the food supply chain if everyone that works there has the virus? Mm-hmm. Is it going to continue on, or is it going to end anyway? Are you going to plug in more people to do the same thing and it infects them as well? And then when that meat comes to your grocery store, after you stand in line to get in your grocery store and you're wearing your mask and your gloves and you go to the meat section, are they going to start placing really large orange stickers on every meat, every package that comes from these infected places and goes, just for full disclosure, this came from the meat packing plant that had 90% of its employees infected. Are you going to buy that meat?
Yeah.
No. Those things are going to be covered up. Those things are not going to happen, but they'll scare you into thinking, oh my God, look, the food supply chain is going to break down. You got to hurry up and kill yourself to make sure. There's ways you can do this. I'm just saying, I'm not saying I have the answers. I don't even know exactly how the transmission of it could be with these types of things. But I get the feeling that if people are told they're getting this meat from places like this, they may not be very comfortable buying it.
I have a theory really fast. I think the person behind this move, you know who it is? It's Cory Booker. You know why I say that? Because if you wanted to create as many vegans as possible, I can't think of any better way to do that than to have 6 months to a year of people associating all meat with getting a fatal disease.
It's gonna,
and they're going to.
It's gonna take a lot, John, because the first couple weeks of this, if you go to the store, there was, you know, everything was off the shelves. We were buying everything. There was no limitations on certain things. I was in like the lunch meat section, hot dogs and stuff, whatever.
Yeah.
All of it was gone except for the vegan and vegetarian options. Those were packed full, just that sliver of the section. And I was like, no matter what, people are not going to buy it.
Try.
It way worse.
You're crazy. Try the Beyond Sausage. Just try it once. It's
no,
good.
I'm not saying people have tried it and they didn't like it. They won't try it. That stuff sits on that shelf and people won't buy it. They're like, yeah, I'll buy the fat-free hot dog before I buy the
Well, stuff. Here's the thing. In those early weeks, when I would go into the store, people might not have been able to buy their sausage, but I was able to get Beyond Sausage, and it was delicious. So these idiots, they really messed up. Good chance you've probably seen some of the footage from Mike Pence's recent visit to a hospital. Here he is, and I want you to notice not what's there, but what's missing. So that's Mike Pence, the guy that I think is still technically in charge of the entire thing, the entire response, not wearing a mask at the Mayo Clinic, even though they later clarified and then deleted the tweet that they had asked him to do it and he declined to do so. Everyone else there being very responsible, wearing personal protective equipment. Mike Pence, not interested, not doing it.
So they had to, first of all, newsflash, if you delete a tweet, you should probably explain why you did, because everyone knows you deleted the tweet. Just heads up for anybody out there. If you delete a tweet, you're going to have to go and explain, because people say, oh, I'm going to come up with a reason why, and that's going to be the narrative. So so when you say he went in there and he denied putting it on, you might as well leave it up, because that's obviously what happened. So in this case, I'm not sure if the outrage is about him going in there without a mask because he's surrounded by folks who potentially have it or are suffering from it or are trying to get over it and he could be infected, or vice versa. Because the first thing I thought was, hey, bro, if you walk around like this in the Mayo Clinic with no mask on, where else are you going around with no mask? Who else are you interacting with no mask?
Yep.
And now there's vulnerable people around you. And who are you passing this on to? This has been the conservative approach to this the whole time. Every time someone says, hey, you know, you can be asymptomatic and still carry it, still have it, still spread it.
Yeah.
They go, oh my God, really? This is new to me.
Yeah. he's like Brian Kemp. He's like, he's just figuring out stuff about it now. Well, look, he was asked about this. So I'm going to give him a chance to respond before I give my thoughts. Here is Mike Pence.
Well, let me say, as Vice President of the United States, I'm tested for the coronavirus on a regular basis. And everyone who is around me is tested for the coronavirus. And when the CDC issued guidelines about wearing a mask, it was their recognition that people that may have the coronavirus could prevent the possibility of conveying the virus to someone else by wearing a mask. And since I don't have the coronavirus, I thought it'd be a good opportunity for me to be here, to be able to speak to these researchers, these incredible healthcare personnel, and look them in the eye and say thank you.
Yeah, would have been tough to look them in the eye with that mask that covers your
also
mouth
let's keep it real
and
keep
not
it real.
Your eyes
keep it real. So what did his appearance, sorry John, you haven't got to a point yet, what is his appearance at the Mayo Clinic on that day have to do with his approach and his tackling of this task force enforcing of the coronavirus? What is his reason for being there outside of a photo op and for political reasoning?
Yeah.
Again, if you talk and speak to everyone, you can go around and do all this. You just want to look them in the eye. That's the reason? You just want to look them in the eye? Or did you want the camera to see you looking them in the eye while you're at the Mayo Clinic?
The thing is, like, I'm not opposed to like photo ops. Like they can do it if they're being responsible. Put on the mask, go there, take some photos. But they can't do that. Okay? He could like, and by the way, I saw someone in the chat said the Mayo Clinic should have denied him access without wearing the mask. 100% right. They should have blocked him. I understand why they didn't. But like in LA, I would get thrown out of a convenience store if I wasn't wearing a mask.
Yes.
He goes in to a hospital, and it reminded me like of a little kid. Well, here's all the reasons why clearly I could never have it, and I don't need to work. Just put it on. Stop with your stupid little evasive excuses and put on the mask, because you still could have talked to them. You still could have done your photo op. I don't want you contributing to people trying to come up with reasons why they don't need to have it. Because I'm feeling fine, because I don't have a fever, because I haven't been around people. There's plenty of reasons why I don't need to wear one. Every American is looking for excuses to not have to abide by the same regulations that everyone else does. That is the core thing at the center of our being as Americans. They don't need to be encouraged in that. And they have been so far from the very beginning. Do you remember this? When Trump says that CDC recommends masks, but he won't wear one, and he will not, saying, I mean, I can't be meeting with like foreign heads of state wearing a mask. I think it'd be a great idea, especially when visiting with visitors from other countries, to not be wearing a mask. This is not about the protection that they have or the testing that they've already done. This is another example of how stupid and dumb and weak conservative masculinity is. They think it looks weak to wear a mask, and so they refuse to do so, even though that leads to a higher chance that they will get a disease that could kill them. It is dumb, dumb, dumb. That's what makes it conservative masculinity.
Ask him if he'll go hang out with Boris Johnson in his face. And share forks and spoons with him. See if they'll share a straw with him, since this is all great. So Mike Pence, by the way, also revealed one other thing, which we knew already, but he goes, I'm not worried about it. I'm the effing vice president of the United States. You know what I can do? I can get tested every day. By the way, that's one of the problems that we've got, is that everyone can't. So when you go and flaunt your privilege and you're like, you know who I am? I can get a test every day. Like, you don't realize how you're pushing that in people's faces who are desperate for a test because they don't know what's happening, or they've got a family member that is sick and they can't get a test, and like, man, it's pretty obvious of what's going on here, but I can't do anything about it. And you go and flaunt, here's my excuse for not wearing a mask, is because I'm the vice president. I can do what I want. I've got access to things that you don't have access to. No, that wasn't his energy in saying that, but you got to think about how you come off.
Yeah.
You got to know the situation and know how you look in conveying it. It's a problem, bro. You got to start connecting. This is what out of touch looks like.
Exactly. And I want to just briefly give credit to one of the people who most forcefully called out why Mike Pence shouldn't have, from the very beginning, shouldn't have been involved in this effort, considering his own record in his own state on matters of healthcare and disease. AOC tweeted in response to this video, when I warned everybody in February that Pence doesn't believe in science and shouldn't be in charge of COVID response, I meant it. But I admit, I did not have VP visits COVID patients without wearing a mask on my bingo board. Yeah, yeah, and I didn't have inject yourself with bleach either. Man, every day is a wake-up call. It's like the damage report, but honestly, it should be the mental damage report, because that is what we're reporting on, is insane news that shouldn't exist. If you are one of the Americans who's been lucky enough to get your stimulus check, which of course millions and millions of Americans have not, what are you going to spend it on? Well, conveniently, the NRA has a suggestion in the April 23rd article of their magazine. They said, check out these sweet deals from more than 10 companies. You can get scope mounts and magazines, and you can turn that stimulus directly into another gun, which is definitely what you need right now. How are you going to survive a disease if you can't shoot it in the face? So if you get that money, Use it for what you need to survive. A gun, JR.
Well, I guess every industry, you know, as people get their stimulus checks or get the little money they get to survive, are going to want to attract people to spend it in their arenas, the ones that are still collecting money in some kind of way. So, I mean, I guess it's not a surprise. It's like any other industry, you know, if somebody makes, you know, whoever makes masks, they're probably doing great. You know, grocery stores are not telling people, hey, don't come buy the Fritos and the Doritos, even though those aren't necessarily needed. Like, hey, still buy them. We'll take their money. So I get companies wanting to still get access to the money people have gotten. It just seems a little morbid in this particular case. So I don't expect him to pull back on it. I would just hope people have enough of perspective to see that this isn't necessary and that they're looking to just get it from you without giving you much in return except for this false sense of security in buying more guns.
Well, and let's bear in mind, this isn't the manufacturers saying it. I mean, I'm sure they're saying it too. This is the NRA, which last I checked does not itself sell guns. So there is a financial connection. We'll get to it in just a sec, but they're not actually the ones selling it. And by the way, look, I think there should have been far more support for different people. And if you don't need it to pay for rent or food or medicine or whatever, it's still yours. You can use it for whatever you want. Seems kind of stupid to me. And I will just say, like, while I think you should be able to spend it on whatever you want, understand that conservatives love to point out when anybody gets money that's being spent on something they don't need. How many broadcasts did Bill O'Reilly do year after year that these supposedly poor people who complain about their pay, they still have money for TVs and microwaves and all this stuff. So if it's something not essential, like a place to store your food or heat it, they will point that out. If it's yet another gun, well, that's essential. Come on, get off our backs.
And but, well, we already, I mean, you go ahead, go ahead. You probably can get to
Really fast. I just want to point out that, look, one of the things that we try to ram home with our coverage of the NRA is that while they will pretend that it's about protecting your constitutional rights, or back in the day, early on, they were trying to say it was about safe and responsible gun ownership and training. It's not about that. It is a it's a lobby front group for the gun manufacturers. It is designed to sell more guns. Take any opportunity, exploit it to sell more guns. And it's not like they don't get paid for this. So four of the seven companies listed in the article have donated to the NRA. Springfield Armory, Crimson Trace, FN America, and Hornaday. Springfield Armory has given between $1 and $4.9 million to the NRA. Crimson Trace has given between $100,000 and $250,000. FN America has given between $50,000 and $100,000. And Hornaday has given between $25,000 and $50,000. So sort of convenient that they get money from the gun manufacturers. And then when this money is going out, suddenly, taking government assistance is a great thing, but give it back to the gun manufacturers, who in turn will give them more money. And they will need it too, because recently times have been hard for the NRA. They're bracing for layoffs as the coronavirus has disrupted fundraising. So sort of convenient that they can turn this crisis into an opportunity for them.
You know, I mean, when you got your lobbying group, when you got your promoters, you got your PR group, which is all the NRA is for these folks, working for you, hey, just let them work. It's like, hey, you guys have been convincing people for long enough. Continue to work for us. We'll continue to hand you the money to do so. It's a, you know, I guess it's the most obvious exchange that we could imagine for Americans right now.
Yeah.
And also, by the way, so also, you know, domestic violence in homes as people are all locked down and quarantine has increased. And then people, in victims of this, in those situations, find themselves trapped with someone who has had these problems in the past. And then to push more guns, you know.
Yep.
It's no different than any other day, but it just seems particularly irresponsible now.
Yeah. And you know, to add on, it's a great point. I want to add on just a little bit more. In early April, CNN reported that of 20 police departments serving large cities that provide statistics, quote, nine saw double-digit percentage jumps in domestic violence cases or 911 calls in March, either compared to the previous year or to earlier months in 2020. And according to the Giffords Law Center, domestic violence incidents involving a gun are 12 times more likely to result in death than those where a gun is not present. And so one inconvenient truth that we continually say is that while you might have fantasies of fighting off bandits with your gun, the people who are most likely to die as a result of you bringing a gun into your home are yourself and those you live with. Those you love, they are the ones whose chance of death rises the second a gun takes residence in your house.
Yep.
But no, everybody's responsible, right? Everybody's a responsible gun owner, except for all those people that accidentally end up shooting themselves or the people that they love. From the beginning, we've been saying on this program that if we are going to formulate a response to coronavirus, check it, to see if it needs to be changed over time, adapted. We should be talking with the experts while doing so. I am not an expert, so we decided, you know what? We're going to bring on an expert, and that's what we've got for you now. Joining us is a risk and behavioral scientist on EcoHealth Alliance's Leadership Council, Dr. Shweta Chakraborty. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you here. We've been doing a bit of reading here at the show of some of the recent articles you've written, interviews you've done, and there's a couple different aspects of this we'd like to talk to you about. One is, in terms of the sort of efforts that have been taken so far, the widespread, at least for several weeks, lockdowns and things like that, what have you made of the response that you've seen in various parts of the country? Would you say that it's sufficient? Are there places where it's gone too far?
Right. So my stance on this hasn't changed from the beginning. We never had conclusive evidence that severe social distancing measures really makes any sort of change on the trajectory of the infectious disease. And that might be shocking for some people to hear, but all of the data that we're using is from the 1918 Spanish flu. That's over 100 years ago. We're talking about a time when women weren't allowed to vote. So society and human behavior has changed significantly in over 100 years. And none of that has been placed into whether or not some of these severe social distancing measures are going to do more net benefit than net harm. We have more recent evidence analyses from more recent infectious disease outbreaks like MERS, like SARS, that some of these measures, like school closures, for example, again, have come out as inconclusive. So places like Sweden, which the rest of the world is looking at with a lot of alarm to say, how are you not putting these severe distancing measures in place? They're doing a much more moderated version. I would argue, as a risk scientist, that without a thorough risk-benefit analysis, we cannot be confident that there is more benefit than cost, that the cost of putting these measures in place aren't actually worse than the benefit to be attained from them. And that's something we're not going to really be able to know until months from now when we look back and really look at which combination of measures really worked and compare some of the policies across states. Like you said, it's been very disjointed. Some places are a lot more lax, some places are a lot stricter. And again, these measures really need to be based on the community transmission of the virus. We need to look at what the base rate statistics are on the ground before we just put some kind of overarching measure in place. It never made sense from the beginning. And human behavior is complex, and we're seeing people are not adhering. Over time, people are going to increasingly stop practicing social distancing. And that's also something that never really got factored into the thought process when we thought about the policies that would make the most sense for this country. And so we really need to think about now moving from severe to moderated, because it's done a lot of harm.
Well, it seems like that's the direction they're going in. So like I said, I'm not an expert, but I do have some follow-up questions. So it seems to me, just viewing this as a person that's been going along with the lockdowns, you know, I had no input on the creation of them. When I look at, like, time-wise, the spread of the disease before and after the lockdowns, in New York, we saw an explosion of cases and deaths, and it seems like since the lockdown has been put in place, it hasn't necessarily gone down drastically, but it also hasn't continued on the trajectory that it's on. When I look at industries that have continued to operate, some forms of transportation, you know, I'm looking at what's happening in the meatpacking plants, supermarkets, things like that, the places where you are still seeing people congregate are seeing a lot of deaths. So my question is, Are you saying that if New York had not instituted social distancing, that the same result would have come about, that we wouldn't have seen more infections or more deaths?
I'm saying the marginal benefit that would have been gleaned from putting these severe social distancing measures in place might not outweigh the harm that has been caused by them. What we're not factoring into the equation is the ripple effects that also result in death. So remember, 600,000 plus Americans a year die from cardiovascular disease. It's the number one killer in the United States. How many of those people, rather than showing up to the ER because ER has been inundated with COVID-19 patients, are now instead dying from heart attack or stroke or some other complication of cardiovascular disease in their homes? That's just one example. So without looking at the big picture, without factoring in all of the secondary and tertiary impacts of these various policies, severe to moderate to mild, we're never going to get a real understanding of exactly what worked and what didn't, and overall, how many people really were benefited, how many lives really were saved. That is what really I fear is going to come out of analysis in the coming months, is that these social distancing measures potentially did more harm than good. That's not to say we shouldn't adhere to them, because if there's any marginal benefit even to be gleaned from practicing quarantine and lockdowns, then people have to comply. Because without that, really, what was the point? So that's really important to remember. If we've made the decision to lock down, we really have to comply to it. Otherwise, it really won't be effective.
So some states are in the process or have already started to reopen. Georgia, you know, they started on Friday and some additional businesses on Monday. And we're seeing other states, especially in that region, doing the same. So are you and other scientists going to be seeing over the course of the next like 1 to 3 weeks to see if now that we have sort of a natural experiment going on where there are some places that are remaining locked down, others that are opening up, to see if we see an uptick in cases or deaths in those areas?
Oh, yes, 100%. I mean, this is what epidemiologists, virologists, social scientists, medical healthcare workers are all working together, hopefully working more together on than not. But that's ultimately what was missing in the beginning. In the beginning, we really just were listening to the epidemiology argument and the public health argument, which of course is the primary perspective when an emerging disease breaks, right? We need to think about the primary impacts of an infectious disease, which is lives lost, and how to stop that from getting worse. But now, as this virus has made its ripple effects through society, from additional risks like mental health, like increased domestic violence, like increased child abuse, all of these upticks that are happening because, again, of the policies that have been put in place, this now requires a larger narrative. Now we need to include a much more multidisciplinary collaboration to be able to get a really good picture of what worked and what didn't. Look, if another wave of COVID-19 comes, we are going to have to treat it in a way that is still going to be aligned to some parts of the society opening back up and the economy opening back up, because these severe social distancing measures were never going to be sustainable for months and months and months into a year. Not in a Western democracy where human behavior, again, is really complex. We're already seeing people no longer adhering, even in places like California, where there's been a lot of support for the policies in place. So this, unfortunately, I see is going to get worse.
So let's talk long term. Let's say that we see some areas that are opening up to greater or lesser extents. So let's hypothesize that we don't see an absolute explosion in cases, and that perhaps, you know, we get some sort of middle of the road policy where you still have new infections, you still have, you know, 1 to 2,500 people dying per day. Long term, what would you advise as an appropriate response to that going forward? If you say that the sort of lockdown we've had isn't sustainable for many months, what would you say would be a replacement for that?
Okay, so firstly, we need to move to moderated lockdown, right? So, sorry, moderated social distancing. So reopen restaurants, reopen community gatherings, and just put in sensible social distancing measures. So keep people 6 feet apart. I don't know if other people are noticing, but now with face masks on, people are standing closer than ever, even within grocery stores where it's very clear that people should be maintaining that 6 feet apart distance. And let kids go back to school, start eating lunches at their desks rather than congregating in cafeterias. These are sensible, cost-effective measures that can be put in place. Enhanced hygiene, that needs to be put in place. All of this just isn't for COVID-19, John, and that's what the takeaway is. This is not the last infectious disease. There might be a second wave of COVID-19, and very well, we know there's going to be another emerging infectious disease somewhere down the line. So these are just good practices to put in place that we can glean off of as we start to get a better picture of the risk landscape once we get more testing in place, right? So all of these things are improving at the same time. So what I'm advising is, alongside increased testing, so we can put a face on this invisible enemy. We need to see who's immune. We need to see who's at high risk. We need to do more genetic testing, because we're finding that up to 50% of the variants that can explain mild to severe symptoms of COVID-19 patients can be attributed to genetics. That's really interesting. That's from one of my alma maters, King's College London, is doing the research into that. We also need increased contact tracing. That's why South Korea did not need to lock down in the way so many of the countries in the world have had to. And then we also need to get on the vaccine bandwagon and just continue to support and to speed up safely a vaccine coming into real use for society. So if all of these things happen together, then I think it's really sensible to start thinking more moderated than severe as the way we've been living. Because again, I think it's been more net harm than good.
You know, I'm interested. Some of the proposals that you said that could theoretically help, like contact tracing and things like that, seem very reasonable to me. What I fear is that many of the sort of people that are right now protesting against the lockdowns, talking about how it's, you know, a huge infringement of their rights and things like that, there seems to be a greater prevalence of certain types of misinformation among that group about the cause of the disease, believing that it's potentially 5G cell towers that are doing it,
right,
about what contact tracing would mean, that is itself a massive interference in people's constitutional rights, that people like Bill Gates are trying to use this opportunity to lower the population with vaccines that'll, you know, stop you from reproducing and things like that. So what do you think about the possibility that some things like more widespread constant testing, making the vaccine nationwide available, doing contact tracing, that some of the people pushing for an end of the lockdowns now might be very resistant to those sorts of solutions?
And I can see that. I mean, look at how scared we are as a community on COVID-19, and everybody wants that vaccine. But ultimately, by the time a vaccine comes available, I definitely will make the hypothesis that we're going to have a significant amount of the population that resists getting the vaccine, the same way we see with the seasonal flu. It's risk-risk trade-offs, right? It's what scares people more. So does the disease scare you more, or does the alternative of the processes that would stop you from getting infected, does that scare you more? So this varies from society to society, culture to culture. Various countries you see have higher and lower risk tolerances. So the reason that places like Sweden have been able to put in more measured policies is because there's a higher just tolerance for being exposed to risk. It's not the same demand to be kept safe. And it's an understanding that we coexist with risk, and it's not up to the government necessarily to protect us from everything. Mm-hmm. So that there's various schools of thought around this, right? But ultimately, it's the risk-risk trade-off. What scares you more, losing your privacy or potentially getting infected? And that's something that it's going to be interesting to see. But ultimately, what are people willing to give up to be safe?
Yeah, but it seems like we should also add on, of course, that when we're talking about risk, we're not purely talking about a risk that you choose to take for yourself. I mean, after all, I can choose not to take the vaccine. I can choose to engage, you know, go about my regular everyday life. I could get the disease. There's a good chance I'm going to be asymptomatic. I'm young. I'm in relatively good health. I might be fine, but I could easily pass on the disease to someone that could get seriously ill or potentially die. So this is a case where it's not like, you know, I make risky decisions with my diet all the time, but I'm not giving anyone else diabetes by doing that, right? Isn't that, like, shouldn't we factor in the fact that this is a particularly infectious disease, that it spreads relatively easily?
Yeah, and so there's a bunch of factors in how we come up with the frequency and probability of this disease, how we perceive it, right? So that's risk perception versus risk reality. And I would argue that voluntary risks that people take are not as voluntary as they think. And also people's own personal problems, like whether or not you take a vaccination whether or not you take a prescription drug to prevent the onset of, let's say, high blood pressure or high cholesterol, that sounds like a personal choice, right? Mm-hmm. But ultimately, we are part of a society that is really interconnected, and individual decision making does not stay with the individual. Because if you choose not to vaccinate your children, we know now, we've been hearing about it in the news, what the ripple effects are, what the consequences of that are. If you choose not to take your medication, especially in the United States, and you end up in the hospital, then that's increased costs for those that have to now deal with the higher cost of those ending up in the hospital than had they been proactive in taking their medications in the first place. These costs are not specific to the individuals, and we are much more connected than we realize. One good example is during 9/11, post 9/11, people decided that they didn't want to be in a situation where they didn't have control, and that they were not in, that they were being involuntarily exposed to risk, like getting on a plane, right? Mm-hmm. And so instead, you saw an uptick of people driving cars. Now that's something I have control over. It's a voluntary risk. Yet the risk of getting in a car is much higher than of getting on a plane. And so that's what ends up happening, is when we start thinking about things like control, catastrophic potential, Familiarity, whether or not a disease impacts children or the elderly, all of these things is true for COVID-19. It triggers all the cognitive hot boxes we have in our head, and that's why we perceive higher risk associated with it than a voluntary activity or a chronic disease, because they're more familiar, because they seem like we have more control. It's a trick our brains play on us. It doesn't mean it's safer.
So I think that we might disagree on some things, but I do agree with you there. And Dr. Shweta Chakraborty, thank you so much for joining us today. We really do appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.